Hi, I'm Dan Beswick, and this is Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out. I am your host for this episode, Dr. Dan Beswick from Los Angeles, California. Today, I am joined by Dr. Waleed Abouzeid from the University of Washington. We will be discussing his team's recent publication, Predicting Surgical Outcomes in Chronic Rhinosinusitis from Preoperative Patient Data, a Machine Learning Approach. Congrats on your publication, Waleed, and thanks for joining me. This is a great article and very topical these days.
Appreciate the invitation, Dan, and love to talk all things AI. Thanks.
That's great. It's great to have you here. You know, AI is a huge topic these days. We hear about it in the newspapers. I hear about it all the time at my hospital with all these initiatives that we're sort of starting. Tell me about your background in AI and sort of the context for this article and where you drew your inspiration from.
Well, the context is really everything around us. You've seen an increasing number of artificial intelligence-based publications in the literature. That is not specific just otolaryngology. It's across the board. And it's even outside the world of medicine. It seems like everywhere we turn, AI is kind of brought to the fore as the next big thing. Specific to medicine and specific to otolaryngology, I think that clinical decision-making, clinical prediction of outcomes, and potentially in the future, even selecting the appropriate treatment for the patient ahead of time are going to be areas where AI can make a world of difference. You know, the advantages of artificial intelligence are the ability to look at thousands of data points concurrently and to potentially find patterns in that data that a human simply would not be able to find and that conventional statistics would not allow us to find. To appropriately weigh those different factors with regards to an association with a particular endpoint of interest, and then to generalize these tools such that they're able to make these predictions on data that the AI model has never actually seen. So that's, you know, the overall premise of artificial intelligence. I think it's going to make a massive difference to the way that medicine is practiced in the future. And I want it to be a part of that revolution, so to speak.
That's fascinating. I like that perspective a lot. And how did you personally sort of get involved in this from the get-go?
Well, you know, one of the advantages of working in an academic center like the University of Washington is that you're on the same campus as a bunch of engineers and other experts in allied fields. And so there's this constant cross-pollination of a kind of academic thought across all of these different specialists. And I was initially working with a group of engineers on an entirely different project that was not artificial intelligence related at all before becoming increasingly involved in the world of AI through various studies on something called computer vision. And then it's turned out that increasingly we're starting to see that our trainees have had some of this background in their pre-residence life. And so one of our residents is actually a highly talented software engineer with an expertise in AI, Arun Raghavan, who's one of the co-authors on the paper. And Arun and I thought, well, wouldn't it be great to start applying some of these tools to some of the prospective data that we've been collecting as a division over the last several years? We've got this huge observational cohort, which is exactly what you need to train these AI models. Lots of patients, lots of rich data, minimal missingness. And given those resources, given that raw material, it just seemed like a natural next step.
You broach a lot of great points there. And before we get too far into it, I do want to talk about the article. But one thing I want to come back to is an idea of, you know, how much data do we need to train these models? So I'll come back to that question later. But before I get too much into the weeds, you know, you've compiled so much of this prospectively collected data and used these models. Tell us about your algorithms, how you design those. And I mean, you included 59 data points and this is an outcome, but describe some of the methods of the article and talk to us about some of that.
Sure. So, you know, the overall, I guess, premise of the article, before we kind of jump into the methods, is that we know that endoscopic sinus surgery is not universally successful in the management of chronic rhinosinusitis. In fact, you look at some of the more recent literature, we're talking medium to long-term failure rate of about 15 to 20% of patients. For being able to predict which patients are going to do well prior to actually stepping into the operating room could have a massive benefit to patients because they get to avoid ineffectual surgery. And of course, to the healthcare providers themselves, since they are able to identify the patients that are most likely to benefit symptomatically from that surgery. And then on the macro scale, the healthcare system, in terms of saving money on surgeries that may not be effective and maximizing good patient outcomes. So the premise here really was to take pre-operative data that was easily accessible, the sort of data that you'd be able to accrue on your very first patient visit. Our goal was to design a tool that was not resource intensive. And as a consequence, we elected not to include data points such as CT imaging, tissue endotyping, the sorts of things that are an additional resource burden. We wanted to make this as simple as possible. And at the University of Washington, we have a prospective observational cohort that's collected in an automated fashion through something called a computer-assisted symptom intake. CASI is essentially used to automate the obtaining of validated questionnaires from patients, so PROMs like the SNOT-22, PHQ-2, various others, along with a whole variety of symptoms. And it's actually specific to the patient's presenting complaint. So every single patient that comes through our clinic is presented with a whole variety of surveys as well as questions. Relatively easy to get through a mobile platform, through their phone, through their laptop, computer, or what have you. There are various ways of filling out this data. And so from 2021 to 2024, we identified 242 chronic sinusitis patients who had undergone primary endoscopic sinus surgery at the University of Washington, all of whom had undergone appropriate medical therapy, your standard topical corticosteroids, plus or minus an anti-inflammatory antibiotic, plus or minus oral corticosteroids. And these patients were then, through CASI, essentially provided us with demographic data, cardinal sinusitis symptoms, comorbidity data, and again, all the PROMs that we talked about. The endpoint that we wanted to train the AI toward was the MCID, the minimum clinically important difference in the total SNOT-22 score when you compare pre- and post-op score. So a decrease of 9 points. And the model development, in order to kind of algorithmically develop these models, you need to have what's called a training set, which you use to basically teach the model, and a test set, which you use to basically validate the model's performance on data that has not been used for training. And so we took this cohort of 242 patients. We split them 80-20, 80% into the training cohort, 20% into the testing cohort. And we looked at a couple of different models. First of all, our kind of ground truth, our base model, was just your standard logistic regression statistical model. And then two AI-based models, machine learning-based models, one of which was called XGBoost. This is really good with tabular data sets, which is essentially what we're looking at. It's better than random forest classifiers, which some of the listeners may have heard about before, because it penalizes decision trees that come up with incorrect predictions. So essentially, it's a weighted average of multiple decision trees. Accumulates all that data together and tries to make the best possible prediction. And as a consequence, it's less susceptible to kind of what's called AI overfitting or model overfitting, and it performs well even if there's some of the data that's missing. And then the other model is something called an ensemble model. This is a concept in AI where you take different models. So you take two or more models, you kind of combine them together, and you see if their essentially discrete predictions can be brought together in order to come up with a higher level of performance in the AI model. So this particular ensemble model combined this XGBoost along with something called a TabNet classifier, which again is great for tabular data. Without getting too far into the weeds here, combining that XGBoost model and the TabNet classifier, i.e. our ensemble model, spits out two different predictions. They're put through something called a logistic regression meta learner, and then basically the best prediction wins, and it gets basically spat out on the back end. So taking these three different models, logistic regression and the two AI models, we fed all the data from the training data set into this. We identified 59 predictors which were associated with that MCID change in total SNOT-22 score, pre- and postoperatively. And we found, once we analyzed model performance statistically, that essentially the ensemble model outperformed the other two significantly.
That's fascinating. So how often is it, you know, how useful is, I should say, is combining these models? Is that something that you would commonly do, or is that some novel aspect of this study? Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, it's well described in machine learning literature. It's well described in the context of, you know, the initial most simplistic machine learning models essentially involve pretty simple mathematical algorithms to kind of spit out a result. Eventually, there was an understanding that if you took an algorithm and ran it through multiple times, so had several decision trees within a single model, you were more likely to come up with a better prediction, because essentially you take a weighted average of the predictions across those decision trees, and that is your output from the AI model. The next step beyond that was to say, well, these AI models work in different ways. Why can't we just take two different models, see what they predict, and then potentially combine those outputs to come up with an enhanced performance model? And so these ensemble models are increasingly used in the world of clinical decision making and prediction. And that's essentially what we did here.
Very exciting. You mentioned CASI, that resource that captures some of the patient reported outcomes in their data. That sounds very useful. I'm sure that was a big boon for the study.
Yeah, absolutely. So CASI, the computer adaptive sinus intake, is just a massive resource for our group. I've got to give credit to Arya Jafari, one of my co-faculty. And so he essentially assembled CASI, which again, allows for this prospective observational cohort. We have an umbrella IRB that allows for essentially every patient that comes through our clinic to contribute to the CASI database. And we've mined this data across a whole variety of publications, not just specific to AI. But of course, as I mentioned earlier, you've got a large cohort of patients, fairly complete data, and that cohort only continues to increase in size over time. And that's a great resource to use for AI-related work.
Exciting. Okay. Yeah, I wish we had something like that here. That sounds like it really facilitates this work and research in general. Thanks for sharing.
Well, it's largely based on REDCap. So certainly the code is something that we've actually shared with other academic centers who are interested in doing the same sort of thing.
Oh, nice. Okay. So we know about the methods and the ensemble model and its better predictor in terms of outcomes. Tell us a bit more about the results. And then, you know, one area that I'm interested in is this is one model. A lot of people have done some AI research recently. If you could touch on sort of, you know, is this model ready for prime time? Discuss a bit more about what's necessary for, if you can enlighten us about sort of the clinical rollout of models like this as they're developed and moving forwards.
So thanks for the question. You know, firstly, to talk about the kind of the bottom line results here without getting too far into the weeds. You know, the ensemble model compared to the XGBoost model, that's the other machine learning model, and compared to the conventional logistic regression was by far and away the highest performer. We looked at a variety of performance metrics, which are considered the gold standard metrics to look at when you're trying to evaluate the performance of your AI model. And these are the accuracy of the model. How often does the prediction that it makes actually dovetail or reflect reality, i.e. How often is the prediction true? Sensitivity, specificity, and something called the area under the curve, or AUC. It's also sometimes called a concordance index. And that's essentially a correlation value that gives you an overall sense as to how well the model performs. With the ensemble model, our AUC approached 0.9. Just to give you a sense as to what that means, if you get an AUC or concordance index of around 0.7 or higher, that's considered likely good enough for clinical use. Above 0.8 to 0.9 is considered excellent performance. And things are, and if you get an AUC above 0.9, which is actually very rare in the clinical realm, that indicates superlative performance. That said, I do need to temper that by saying that despite metrics of 0.89 for the AUC, a specificity of 93.3, a sensitivity of about 85.3, and an accuracy that approaches 90%, this was tested on a cohort of 242 patients, or developed over 242 patients. One of the things that's often missing in the AI literature and would be the next step that we're looking at is to take a multi-center cohort of CRS patients that have never been subject to the model, that reflect the heterogeneity of patients that are seen in all of our clinics nationally, and to evaluate the model's performance in that much larger external validation cohort. And so in answer to your question with regards to whether or not this is ready for kind of prime time and clinical use, well, not until it's externally validated. I think we're at a point where we have a model that's very close to being ready for that external validation, and currently accruing patients for that external validation. Not only with regards to our study, but other AI studies, external validation really is the gold standard in terms of ensuring that the performance of your model is where it should be. Going back to what this study actually showed as far as the ensemble model, well, if you note that the very high specificity and the high accuracy, that essentially suggests that the ensemble model could be used for the rule-in of patients who are likely to achieve MCID after primary endoscopic sinus surgery. Again, using only preoperative data as input. The XGBoost model, on the other hand, kind of didn't do that well from a specificity standpoint. Again, its specificity was only around 47% compared to 93% for ensemble, but it had a really high sensitivity. As a matter of fact, its sensitivity exceeded that of the ensemble model and absolutely exceeded that of the logistic regression. The sensitivity of the XGBoost model was about 97%. So again, high sensitivity, low specificity suggests that XGBoost, in contrast to ensemble, would be great at rule out of cases that are unlikely to achieve the MCID. Now, perhaps the best option is to kind of combine these models, and that's something that we postulate in the discussion of our paper. You could potentially use XGBoost on an initial pass-through just to kind of find patients that are unlikely to respond to surgery. You rule those out right off the bat. And you take the remaining cohort of patients who may do well with surgery, feed their data into an ensemble model, and then it will identify the cohort within that population that are highly likely to do well following endoscopic sinus surgery. So that ultimately would be the kind of end use once the model is validated.
That two-tiered approach.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And you mentioned sort of the next step as a prospective or as an external validation involving multi-center patients. Help us understand, when would you choose to use the existing model and run that through a multi-center cohort? Or when would you choose to start afresh or start anew and use a bigger group of multi-center patients? And, you know, could a different model perform in a superior fashion? How do you think about that, those options?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think that before we embark on these studies, we essentially come up with performance characteristics that we want to see in the model. And if the model meets those performance characteristics, and then again, actually continues to prove that performance in a validated, in an external validation cohort, well, then you've essentially met your aims and that model is suitable for use. That said, a larger training or development cohort may potentially lead to better performance, not only through this model, but through other machine learning models that are out there. And so this is kind of the beauty of this particular space, in that there's always the opportunity to continue to improve performance. Hmm. Again, AI is highly sensitive to the size of these training and development cohorts, but I'm certainly not ruling out, you know, version 2 or version 3 of this thing down the line, whereby we come up with models with even higher performance.
Thanks for sharing that information. And so what would you say, you know, what's the ideal model size for the training set and the validation set that you're looking for in your initial cohorts when embarking upon work like this?
Yeah, that's a super complex question. I mean, the larger, the better for sure. You know, so one of the kind of characteristics, the architecture of these AI models that's worth touching upon is this idea of kind of a black box or a glass box. So what we're presenting here are more black box models. These are models whereby you kind of feed in a whole bunch of data, a variety of different variables, and then the model is doing all these mathematical calculations in the back end and then telling you, hey, these are the predictors that are probably the most important in the model, and we identify those in the manuscript with regards to the ensemble and XGBoost models, as well as the logistic regression model. But the thing is, you can't really lift the cover and see what the model is actually doing to that data. How is it manipulating that data? What modifications is it applying to those variables? And with regards to the variables themselves, really all you can come up with is kind of a relative weighting of importance. How important is one variable relative to another? But really nothing more granular than that. So that is the black box, which is what the vast majority of AI models do. You don't really know what they're doing behind the scenes. And because of that, you need fairly large patient populations. You're talking several hundred patients typically for the training. And then you're going to want a fairly sizable cohort as well for validation. Again, the validation cohort can be a little bit smaller, but certainly for the development and the training, you're going to want several hundred patients. This is in contrast to a glass box model. So a glass box model is one where you've identified characteristics, and you know we know that in the literature, IFAR certainly carries a lot of these publications, where a variety of other esteemed investigators have identified variables and factors that correlate with surgical outcomes. Now, you could take a model and deliberately feed in those variables that we know have previously been identified to associate with surgical outcomes. So you know exactly what's being fed into the model. And you can tweak the weighting of all those different variables, you know, under the hood, so to speak, and then see how the model performs. So in that model, you've got a much more granular context of exactly what variables are feeding into the model and how those variables are feeding into the model on the basis of all that prior literature. So these glass box models have the advantage of allowing for a much smaller development size. So in that context, you could probably get away with less than 100 patients for development. And again, a subset of that, maybe 20% of that patient cohort, again, for validation or testing of the model. So, you know, the fact is, there's not a clean answer to how many patients do you actually need. Suffice to say that the vast majority of black box AI models that are reported in the literature typically require several hundred patients for a reasonable run at decent performance.
Very informative. Thanks for all that information. I think it's amazing in your study that even without including, you know, CT findings or serum eosinophil count findings, or, you know, with primarily patient reported and written data, your models were so accurate. So it's exciting to see where this is going to go in the future. I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, thanks so much. I mean, again, it harkens back to the very first part of our conversation, which is that there are patterns in the data that AI allows us to see that we wouldn't be able to see otherwise. And it's important to note, and again, prior literature has demonstrated this, that some of these symptoms that patients report do correlate with some of the objective measures that we've then subsequently obtained through, you know, more resource-intensive measures, whether it's CT scans, so on and so forth. And so perhaps, again, that those symptoms the patient's reporting to you, you know, contain more data than we're able to see.
Interesting, interesting. All right, so left field question here, out of left field, but jumping ahead 5 or 10 years, you know, thinking about AI and the field of rhinology and otolaryngology medicine, where do you think we'll be in half a decade and a decade in terms of, you know, how AI is going to be incorporated into not all but many practices in our country?
Well, I think we'll likely have a you know, kind of a vertically integrated system whereby at every step of patient management, every encounter with a patient, you potentially have an AI tool, hopefully an integrated AI tool that'll help with decision making. You know, we're beginning with a relatively rudimentary version of that. We had already published a paper on trying to determine who has chronic sinusitis. This paper that we're talking about here, of course, is attempting to predict which patients are going to do well from sinus surgery. And we're currently working on a paper to determine who's likely to fail medical therapy, right? So that's the entire kind of diagnostic and management pipeline, if you think about it, right? Diagnosis, who's got it? Who's going to do well with medical therapy versus who's not? And then of those patients you take to the operating room, who's going to do well and who's not? So in the future, 5 or 10 years from now, I can imagine an integrated model whereby you feed in the data, hopefully in a fairly seamless fashion, where essentially the data is taken directly out of the electronic medical record and fed into these AI models. And as part of your workup on the same day that you're seeing the patient, it spits out an output that could be on a continuous scale, you know, on a 0 to 100 scale, how likely this patient is to have a diagnosis or to do well from surgery. And you could use that in your real-time decision-making. So that ultimately is the goal in 5 or 10 years, you know, models that are so efficient that they can essentially be run concurrently in real time with your clinic encounter with a patient. Of course, we're talking simply about, you know, diagnosis and predicting outcomes, but you could take this as far as you want. You could talk about intraoperative decision making. You could have models that essentially look at the video input from the endoscope, right? Computer vision, to try and determine whether a particular surgical move is going to be beneficial or not for the patient, which moves are going to have high morbidity versus those that are going to likely result in a quality of life improvement for the patient. So, you know, again, these are all areas where increasingly I'm excited to see a lot of investigators. It's hardly a month that goes by where you don't see a manuscript in IFAR that has something to do with AI. I'm just excited to see where it can go with this.
That's a fascinating future. I'm excited about it too. Okay, so we're towards the end here. Just the last couple of questions. Anything else? And we've talked a lot about your paper, which is really exciting, and sort of thinking about the future, what can happen in the next 5 or 10 years, and how AI will be incorporated. Anything else you want to share with us today, or any advice you'd offer to other investigators who are sort of starting out in this realm that you're more established in about AI research and rhinology in general?
Certainly. Again, thanks for the opportunity to comment. You know, I would say, you know, do some kind of basic reading around the topic. You know, there's certainly a lot out there. I think that, you know, ironically enough, we've got these large language models that'll spit out a fairly, you know, comprehensive kind of premise as to what AI and machine learning is all about. And the other thing is, you know, apart from kind of keeping an open mind and trying to learn about this new technology, which could potentially prove to be revolutionary, is to try and engage with those whose expertise is in this area. So, you know, we're clinicians, we're experts in that. There are, you know, software engineers and AI engineers who have a tremendous amount of expertise in this area and are just looking to find uses for their technology. And so, you know, we're in a very enviable position of serving as that bridge or liaison between the worlds of clinical medicine and the worlds of AI engineering, and really identifying for these engineers the areas of unmet need and helping guide and collaborate with them in the development of these sorts of tools. So I'd encourage kind of looking outside of the silo of traditional academic medicine, and if you have the opportunity, interacting with those whose expertise and day-to-days in the world of AI, you'd be surprised what potential overlap and collaborations can come out of that.
That's great advice. Thank you for that. All right. Well, once again, I'm Dan Beswick. This is Waleed Abouzeid. We've been discussing his team's article, Predicting Surgical Outcomes in Chronic Rhinosinusitis from Preoperative Patient Data, a Machine Learning Approach. Thanks for listening, and check out the full article in IFAR if you're interested. Thanks so much, Dr. Abouzeid, for being with us today.
Thank you, Dan, and appreciate the invitation, Dr. Beswick and team. Thanks so much.